You're listening to the Diplomats podcast on Asian geopolitics. I'm Ankit Panda, host of the podcast and an editor at the Diplomat, and I'm joined on today's episode by my colleague Prashant Parameshwaran. Thanks for joining me, Prashant.
Yep, good to be here.
I'm glad to have Prashant here with me today to talk over the U.S. Navy's recent activities in the South China Sea. We've been doing this South China Sea update series of podcast episodes, and they've sort of become a regular thing, and I'm happy to keep it going as the region continues to stay hot throughout the year. On the 30th of January 2016, local time in the South China Sea, the U.S. Navy conducted its first freedom of navigation operation of the year in the area, and the first actually since the October 27, 2015 operation in the Spratly Islands. Now, this time, the excessive maritime claims that were being challenged were in the Paracels, specifically off Triton Island, a single feature. The USS Curtis Wilbur and Arleigh Burke-class guided missile destroyer sailed within 12 nautical miles of the island. According to Ashton Carter, the U.S. Defense Secretary, the operation challenged attempts by the three claimants, which are China, Taiwan, and Vietnam, in the case of Triton Island, to restrict navigation rights and freedoms around the features they claim by policies that require prior permission or notification of transit within territorial seas. That was verbatim from Ash Carter, and that's a very specific sort of claim that they're that the U.S. Navy was trying to protest by undertaking this freedom of navigation operation. Now, as I always like to note when talking about these operations, the U.S. Navy was not challenging the issue of who owns the island itself. The United States takes no position officially on the sovereignty of individual features. What it does care about is the maritime rights that are generated off of these features. So I just want to start this podcast, Prashant, by just talking about, you know, some of the things that, you know, I noticed about this freedom of navigation operation, particularly with, you know, particularly things that were different from the October freedom of navigation operation. And I should note for listeners that, you know, this discussion will get a little bit in the weeds in terms of international maritime law, but I'll include some links since it's kind of tough to have a discussion about these complex issues in the South China Sea without talking about things like the 1982 United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea. So if this does get a little bit too in the weeds, hopefully the background reading of the description will be a good place to start to understand some of these issues. So there are, you know, a lot of major differences between what we witnessed last week in the Paracels and what we witnessed in October in the Spratlys. And just to be clear, that Spratly operation also involved an Arleigh Burke-class destroyer sailing within 12 nautical miles of Subi Reef, among other features. And Subi Reef is important because it's one of the facilities where you might have heard in the news that China has been constructing artificial islands with potentially military uses. So the first thing that I noted about, you know, this freedom of navigation operation that really struck me, and here you'll have to pardon my bias as a writer covering these issues in the South China Sea, is that I really appreciated how communicative the United States government was about the freedom of navigation operation. I mean, Ashton Carter had a letter out there, had a statement out there within 24 hours of the operation clarifying specifically what was being challenged, and you contrast that to the October operation where, if my count is right, it took 95 days before we heard from the Secretary of Defense himself what and why the United States had, you know, sent the Lassen within 12 nautical miles of Subi Reef. So that was a welcome development since, you know, the United States claims that the freedom of navigation operations aren't a political statement. They're simply the U.S. Navy asserting customary international law. So it makes sense that they'd be communicative about that. The you know, a lot of the criticisms of the October operation suggested that by being silent about it, the United States is making this more about, you know, China and the bilateral tensions there over its island building. So that was a plus. And this actually sort of brings me to my second point, which is the operation itself was just clean cut. I mean, it was pretty straightforward. It was challenging the prior notification requirement for innocent passage. And here, you know, the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea matters because Article 18, which delineates what's known as innocent passage, says nothing about prior notification. In fact, prior notification can't be a requirement for innocent passage. Essentially, military vessels are allowed to transit within 12 nautical miles of an island or a rock as long as they as long as they don't conduct certain activities, which include, you know, overt intelligence gathering, launching sort of aircraft in the region or helicopters or anything like that. So that, you know, essentially made this freedom of navigation way less controversial mechanically. And there was no sort of discussion about, you know, what is the United States actually kind of protesting in this sense. So Prashant, before, you know, I talk about some of the other things, I wanted to, you know, give you a chance to kind of talk about, you know, your reactions to just the mechanics of the operation. What did you make of the operation itself?
Yeah, I mean, I think both in terms of the how the U.S. managed it, as well as what was being challenged. I think those were the two critical differences between the two operations. Obviously, this one was a little bit more straightforward because of the status of Triton relative to Subi Reef in terms of its status in international law. So that made it a little bit more straightforward. I think with the Lassen operation, there was a lot more legal ambiguity as to both what the United States was challenging specifically, and then also in terms of China's response, what China was claiming initially. So that both made the U.S., what the U.S. was doing, and then what China's reaction was a little bit more complicated relative to what was going on this time. I think one similarity, and I think you alluded to this point earlier, is that both of these operations, in terms of the full spectrum of what is possible, in terms of freedom of navigation operations, are relatively modest in terms of what they're trying to accomplish. So they're very cautious operations. And I think the key thing, which maybe we'll talk about later, is how can these operations become more complex later on? So I noted in a piece that I'd written that Harry Harris had mentioned that these operations could become more complex and broader further down the line. So that's, I think, the next thing that, you know, we could potentially look for, because both of these operations, as I mentioned earlier, are a little bit, you know, less, I would say less complex and less sophisticated and more sort of, you know, I guess I don't want to say more basic, but definitely less controversial in terms of the full spectrum of activity.
Right. Yeah, that actually reminds me. I should have talked about, you know, how Triton Island is very different from Subi Reef. I mean, so first of all, it's Triton Island is pretty much a rock or an island. There's no question about that. Subi mm-hmm. Reef, however, is an artificial island now, but there's some debate over what it used to be before. I think it's more likely than not that it was a what is known as a low tide elevation, which means that at high tide, the feature was entirely submerged before China began any activity there, which means that under international law, it has no entitlement to a territorial sea. And that's actually something that's currently under consideration at the Permanent Court of Arbitration in The Hague, where the Philippines has asked international lawyers to kind of take a look at these claims and make a determination over what these features are. Triton Island was a lot more clear-cut. Prashant, you know, there's also the issue of the straight baselines in the paracels, and that's actually something the United States didn't challenge with this freedom of navigation operation. Mm-hmm. In the paracels, unlike in the Spratlys, China has drawn straight baselines that are essentially illegal under international law, with a few exceptions, primarily for archipelagic states, and obviously China isn't one of those. So the straight baselines are not legal, and this operation didn't actually challenge that. So there was, you know, some of the commentators I follow on the South China Sea had said, you know, that could have been a way to make this a less modest operation. You know, my prediction was actually, Prashant, that the next freedom of navigation operation we'd have seen was in Mischief Reef, and there's obviously a lot of reasons why that's, I think, you know, the most likely place for the United States to go if it really does want to take its freedom of navigation operations to the next level and really make a statement.
Exactly. Yeah, that would have been more bolder, and also particularly if they had done that, you know, without innocent passage. So it, like you were mentioning earlier, the issue is really not just what's being challenged or how the U.S. responds, but what activities are conducted while they're transiting, right? So innocent passage requires the ships to traverse continuously and expeditiously, right?
Right.
So if they had done it and done it in a, accompanied by, you know, the launching of aircraft, like you were mentioning earlier, or stopping for an exercise, that would have been a much bolder demonstration of what the United States was doing and send a much clearer message. But I think, you know, as with the former operation and this one, the administration has balanced needing to clarify some of these rights with, you know, being worried about what the Chinese reaction might be and how to manage the U.S.-China relationship. So that very much is also in the minds of the individuals in the administration and those carrying out the operation as well.
Right, right. I do want to talk a bit about why Mischief Reef is so good, since it might not be apparent to, you know, all of our listeners. So Subi Reef is similar to Mischief Reef in that they're both low tide elevations, like I described. So neither of them, you know, taken alone as an independent feature, is entitled to any territorial sea. But Subi Reef is within 12 nautical miles of other features that might possibly be entitled to a 12 nautical mile sea. And, you know, due to the quirks of international law, It could turn out that Subi Reef is entitled to that, and the United States wasn't eager to take a position on that since that would require essentially, you know, making determinations about sovereignty, so they decided to be safe and practice innocent passage. Mischief Reef is within 12 nautical miles of no plausible feature that could give it a territorial sea, so that's actually, you know, it's good because it's the only one of the seven artificial islands that China's built that has that quality, which means that if the United States does a freedom of navigation operation there, it pretty much has to, you know, do something that's prohibited by innocent passage to make a point that they don't recognize territorial waters there for any claimant. You know, it doesn't matter if China's built an artificial island there. It's simply a feature that can't have that under international law is what the United States would have to say. But obviously, there's a lot of political considerations, you know, that would seriously affect the bilateral relationship. I think China would see that as a lot more provocative than these first two, which actually brings me to, you know, China's reaction. Prashant, what do you, you know, what are your observations about how China reacted when, you know, to this freedom of navigation operation and the one back in October?
Yeah, so I think the Chinese reaction, you know, as usual, was pretty heated, talking about how the United States was using freedom of navigation to advance hegemonic ambitions in the region, and the fact that, you know, contrary to what some have been saying, it's not China that's militarizing the South China Sea, it's the United States through such moves. Mm-hmm. I think the critical distinction, I think you noted this in your piece as well, was that unlike the first operation, no Chinese, well, at least according to U.S. sources, no Chinese vessels actually escorted the U.S. vessel during the mission, right? So this is according to the Pentagon spokesman. I think the Chinese reaction, as I alluded to earlier, one way in which it was different, which was brought about by the nature of this operation relative to the previous one, was that because the Chinese are more specific about what they claim, so China does claim a territorial sea around the Paracels, they could have been much more specific and much less vague relative to the first operation, where they haven't explicitly said what their claim to Subi Reef is, even though, you know, there are many who speculate what that claim might be. China hasn't actually clarified in public whether it's entitled to a territorial sea or not. So yeah, those, I think, were the two key distinctions, yeah.
Yeah, and actually on that second point, you know, I actually noticed, you know, I kind of call this a bonus of this freedom of navigation operation that kind of makes it, you know, more useful in my opinion. If you look at the foreign ministry statements from China after both operations, there's a really, really interesting distinction that I haven't really seen too many people talk about. So after the Paracel operation, as you correctly noted, you know, China does claim a territorial sea there. So what the Chinese foreign ministry said was, and this is a quote, "The U.S. Navy vessel violated the relevant Chinese law and entered China's territorial sea without authorization." Compare that to what China said back in October in the Spratlys, where, you know, I'll remind listeners that there are no straight baselines. China hasn't really clarified what it claims. Then what China had said is that essentially that freedom of navigation operation threatened China's sovereignty. So there's no mention of a territorial sea. It simply said threaten China's sovereignty, which was, you know, that's an interesting distinction since it shows that China does conceive of the entitlements that it has from, you know, in the Spratlys and in the Paracels very differently. And, you know, I think that is partly a function of the fact that we don't have straight baselines in the Spratlys like we do in the Paracels, but also, you know, it means that the outcome of the case at The Hague is going to be even more, you know, clarifying when it comes to China's actual claims there.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So Prashant, let me ask you, let me kind of open up this conversation a bit and, you know, talk a bit about the regional context. So Prashant's our editor who focuses primarily on Southeast Asia, so this is kind of his wheelhouse. Prashant, you know, I've been reading that the Philippines is, you know, potentially going to get involved in these operations. Do you think that's a good idea to kind of join the United States and both patrol these disputed features?
Yeah, I think the United States has been in discussions with a number of its allies in the Asia Pacific about potentially getting involved in some of these freedom of navigation operations further down the line in some form or the other, or potentially conducting other activities that might help clarify some of these navigation rights. So the Philippines is one, Japan is another, and Australia is also considering sort of doing more in this regard. With the Philippines, on the one hand, it does make sense because the Philippines is one of the more forward-leaning claimants within Southeast Asia and the South China Sea. And the U.S. and the Philippines are allies as well, and that makes coordination significantly easier. I mean, the issue really is the timing of what that operation, when that operation might take place. So, as you mentioned earlier, there's a critical point when we're talking about the South China Sea in 2016. The outcome of the arbitration case is going to be in the middle of this year, as predicted. And so the issue is really whether the Philippines would want to join something like this before the outcome of the case is actually comes out, or whether they would prefer to do it once there actually is an outcome. And there is not significantly more clarity, but maybe a little bit more additional clarity about what international law says about this issue. So that's the problem for the Philippines, and sort of whether they would do this, and not only whether, but when they'll actually take part in it too.
Right. I also want to ask you about Vietnam's reaction to this latest operation. So Vietnam claims the parasols as well, and the Vietnamese reaction was very different from China in that they essentially said that they respect the right of innocent passage and didn't really make a huge fuss about it. They didn't actually say that they would. Vietnam also requires prior notification, which is actually illegal under international law, but they didn't make any sort of statement about that. But what do you make of that reaction, Prashant? What does it tell us about how Vietnam sees the U.S. role in the South China Sea?
Yeah, I think it tells us two things. One is that I think a lot of the attention tends to be focused around China and how this is a U.S.-China issue. But as you indicated earlier, and as the United States pointed out, they're challenging sort of claims that various countries are making, and that includes China, but also other countries like Vietnam, Taiwan, et cetera, et cetera. So this is not merely a U.S.-China bilateral issue. The second thing that it tells us is that when the United States initially conceived of these freedom of navigation operations, Vietnamese officials were actually quite nervous about that because they were worried about which features specifically would be challenged, because that has implications not only for China but also Vietnam. And I think the Vietnamese have been thinking hard about how they're going to respond and how to calibrate the response. And eventually, what they came down on was the fact that they were going to say that they respected the right to innocent passage, but they were also going to similarly, as China does and as various claimants do at various points, reiterate the fact that they still have sovereignty over the Paracels and the Spratlys. I think it's also interesting what was not said, because the prior notification angle is a pretty significant component, as you mentioned earlier. So I think the Vietnamese have been thinking about this for a long time, and they calibrated their response very clearly to show that, while on the one hand they respect certain elements of the U.S. operation, they're going to continue, their claims haven't changed explicitly.
Yeah. No, I think I agree with that entirely. I also wanted to ask you about ASEAN's role. Laos is chairing ASEAN now, and John Kerry was recently just in Laos. It was kind of part of the United States' first international outreach for 2016 in Asia. What do you think, ASEAN's role will be with regard to the South China Sea? Obviously, Laos, isn't a coastal state, has close ties with China. The South China Sea is much lower on its radar than it is for some of the other ASEAN states that are claimants. What do you make of ASEAN's prospects this year?
Yeah, so I think there are a few things you can say about that. So first is, as you correctly mentioned, Laos is not a claimant in South China Sea disputes. So the expectations among the United States and other ASEAN countries, as well as interested parties like Japan and Australia, is primarily that Laos continues to keep the South China Sea issue on the agenda, that several joint statements at key ASEAN meetings continue to reflect the existing consensus on the South China Sea, and there's no sort of, there's no backsliding on the consensus that exists, and that there continues to be at least movement or calls for a binding code of conduct in the South China Sea between ASEAN and China. I think the other thing to watch that'll be interesting beyond the multilateral ASEAN meetings that usually go on throughout the year is the upcoming U.S.-ASEAN summit in Sunnylands. The agenda hasn't officially been released, but my understanding is that the South China Sea issue is, obviously going to be discussed by the ASEAN countries as well as the United States. So it'll be interesting to see, to the extent that a joint statement comes out from that meeting, what the language is going to be on the South China Sea, because obviously that's going to be one of several issues are going to be discussed, including, you know, the Islamic State and other U.S.-ASEAN economic issues. And the U.S. and Laos are both chairing that meeting jointly. And as you correctly pointed out, Kerry's trip to Laos was partly to sort of come up with the agenda for that meeting. So that will be another interesting angle to watch going forward.
Great. Well, Prashant, thanks for joining me and for providing that helpful context of ASEAN and the Southeast Asian countries' roles. To our listeners, thanks for listening. We'll be definitely continuing this South China Sea update series this year. As Prashant said, the Permanent Court of Arbitration decision will obviously be a huge event for the South China Sea this year, and we're also anticipating more freedom of navigation operations, potentially near Mischief Reef, so we'll be back to talk about that. Prashant, thanks a lot for joining me.
Yep.
And if you like the podcast, do leave us a review on iTunes, and make sure to subscribe. Thanks a lot for listening.